Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus. You have accessed entry 1044.EZ0510, certificate number 51638. James Frazier Reed.
We probably talk about this every time we see each other, but do you think you would eat human flesh?
We do talk about this a lot.
Let's say you're a rugby player. Let's say your rugby team is in a crash coming back from a game against... You were on the Gonzaga rugby team?
Yeah, we were playing Chile.
So let's say you're playing against Uruguay or Chile, and your plane crash is coming back. Would you rather eat or be eaten?
Well,
apparently neither is not an option.
The only way that they would eat me is if they killed me, because I'm a survivor. I'm not going to voluntarily, you know, they're going to have to catch me.
A plane hitting a mountain, there's no way that could kill you.
No, they're going to have to catch me first.
One of your fellow rugby, but they probably could. From your descriptions of your rugby performance, they may be faster than you.
Oh, right, but they would have to get me down on the ground, which is harder. You can catch me, but can you kill me?
There'd be a scrum, as we say.
I mean, they might dogpile, but, you know, I'm also pretty wary, right? So I'm not going to let you get behind me. Especially if you're carrying a machete or a wrench, you know, I'm going to keep everybody in front.
You've got some experience.
I'm a little bit of a herder. Yeah. But as far as eating, I've thought about this a lot, of course, not just because we talk about it all the time, but
I don't know if we ever have,
because it's one of those things where you're like, you read the accounts of people on a ship, you know, floating in the ocean on a boat where they end up having to eat each other or caught in a mountain pass or whatever, and you think, I don't know what it would take. How hungry do you have to be?
I think I would be a pretty easy sell.
To eat a person.
Yes. And here's what I'm thinking. I feel like today, we've already had to confront the idea that we are no longer eating meat for survival, that we are now choosing to eat intelligent things with eyeballs and personalities.
Whoa, okay. This is a weird, like, proto-vegetarian argument. But you're just saying, like, if you're going to eat a cow, why not eat a human?
Well, it's a smaller step. So I was reading this book last night, like a memoir set in rural England, like Oxfordshire Village in the 1890s. And it really emphasizes any new source of pig and any new source of food is, like the one time a year when the family mills its flour, they set up their bag of flour in the parlor so that any visitors will come in and admire their bag of flour. But it really, it mostly manifests itself through the pig. And it really is just a sign of prosperity and survival, you know, that they're going to, it's a festival when they butcher that thing, and it's not pleasant. You know, the kids know deep down but everybody's just happy because it means we're not going to die this winter. And that, just 100 years later, we're now in a world where I could eat a Beyond Burger every day. And every time I don't, I'm choosing to eat something that used to breathe and perhaps frolic. And the act of kind of willful compartmentalization I have to perform to eat a lamb chop today, it's just not that different from me eating a John chop if I'm on the plane.
I mean, I suppose it's a question of how much. It's not just we do this a lot in the modern era where we assume that that all of our habits are just because we are used to them, and without culture, we would all just be blank slates, and you could take any human baby and just feed it dandelion greens, and the baby would never think to eat a meat.
Not true, of course.
Right. Like eating meat is something, or I mean, you know, we're omnivores by nature, right? So it's, I think that I had cauliflower pasta the other day.
Oh yeah.
And it was the first time I'd eaten pasta that wasn't just pasta that I felt legitimately fooled. Like, that's good. I would eat cauliflower pasta. And even more than Beyond Burger, which is also good, I felt like that was the revolution where they had
cauliflower.
And by them, I mean they.
The secret ingredient was always cauliflower.
And by them, they, I mean the UFOs who are gradually like letting their technology permeate our culture.
Our secret vegan lords.
So rather than give us free energy, they've given us cauliflower pasta. And I'm there. I'm all the way there. It's like, I'll use Beyond Burger now because they've got cauliflower pasta. Whereas putting Beyond Burger on regular pasta only solved half the problem for
exactly.
me. But Beyond Burger on cauliflower pasta, like, take me away, Calgon.
Many human societies have performed cannibalism over the centuries, although it's difficult to know.
Intentionally? or
how does accidental cannibalism, like you trip and you fall and you take a bite out of your friend's elbow head toward the ground?
Do they shoo the pigs out of the way on their way to go kill like a chubby young boy?
Yeah, so most of our... You know, most of our 19th century accounts of cannibalism are suspect just
sure.
because they were performed by, you know, racist colonialist types seeing new behaviors for the first time. And recent scholarship makes a lot of what they found look dubious. You know, a lot of the assumptions were, yeah, this tribe uses human flesh as a primary food source. And that's not really... a thing. It appears that where cannibalism was and is practiced, it's got a, you know, a ritual.
Right. A religious component. You consume yeah. your enemy's heart or something.
Or a medicinal component, which is actually not that different from, medieval Europe through like the Renaissance and after. It was still not uncommon to associate different healthful qualities with human blood and organs. And
that's why I eat my fingernails.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, for medicinal purposes.
Gross.
Yeah. It's a kind of a colonic.
I mean, most people chew them.
No, you got to eat them. Because then your fingernails are actually inside scraping away at the inside of your intestine. It's like scratching except from inside. And you use your own fingernails.
So refreshing. So yeah. Satisfying.
I don't actually do that. Please don't write me.
What do you think human flesh tastes like? Have you ever read the accounts?
Seems like it would be very gamey, very like iron tasting.
We're not svelte antelopes running through the woods.
No, but
we're marbled.
We don't have we're not vegetarian, right? So all the delicious creatures are eating grain.
Well, you are. You'll taste better once you make the full switch to California rice at Chipotle.
That's right. But that's true, right? I mean, prey animals are mostly vegetarian. I mean, you would never eat a tiger.
You wouldn't download a tiger.
Right? I mean, you wouldn't eat even a fat tiger. Even a zoo tiger, you're not going to say like, marbled tiger fat, because there's something about a carnivore that
intensifies the meatiness of the meat.
Yeah, I just presume that it's bad. And when you think about like all
we don't eat that many. I mean, no carnivores are hardly ever eaten.
What
right?
is a carnivore that you have ever eaten?
I've had alligator.
Yeah, I've eaten bear.
Bears are semi-carnivores. They're omnivores, right?
Yeah, it's not delicious. But also, I feel like the evidence that human beings are not good is that most top predators also don't want to eat us, right?
That's because, like, we're so wily.
It's just like they all prefer elk to us, or in the case of sharks, water elk.
That's probably the water elk, as I call the manatee. That's just got to be ease of, I mean, we're kind of bony and spiky. We stand up.
We have guns.
There's really nowhere you can take a bite out of us that won't have a ton of just ribs and cartilage in it.
Yeah, I think there, you often see an animal eats us, I mean, bites us, kills us.
And then loses interest.
And then it's just like, ugh.
Wanders off.
Yeah.
There are accounts of what, there are human accounts, modern accounts of what human flesh tastes like.
Oh, really?
Generally, the consensus is it looks like beef, tastes like pork. Although the most detailed account is from one William Seabrook, a early 20th century explorer who in West Africa wrote a famous account of just eating human meat with a African tribe, and can't overstate how much it tastes like veal. Just the best veal he's ever
had.
Veal? Yeah.
Come on.
Maybe it's how you serve it. Maybe they served it with some Parmesan and...
Come on. He's, you know what? That feels like Orientalist too.
Well, I think his account was later suspect.
That sounds like some Hemingway baloney.
Yeah, I think, is that what you call human flesh? Hemingway baloney?
Hemingway baloney.
I'd like to have a big bite of Hemingway baloney if
long
you know
what I mean. Long pig.
It's not always, I mean, cannibalism is not illegal everywhere. Even today, as I found out.
Go on.
A couple of years ago when a Japanese performance artist named Mao Sugiyama held a happening. In which he served, he's a self-proclaimed asexual.
Sure.
Which to most people just means they'd rather watch TV and go to bed.
But not interested.
Yeah. In his case, it means he sliced off his procreative organs and pan-fried them with some button mushrooms and Italian parsley and served them to six high-paying guests at an art happening for his 22nd birthday. Do you have any follow-up questions?
I'm almost never completely nonplussed, but...
You're usually so plussed.
I'm really plussed under most circumstances, but that is really... that has rendered me speechless.
I was getting into the, you know, he actually did invite a larger group of people, but he didn't have enough to go around.
Why not? You could cut it into smaller and smaller bites. How much of an artist's penis do you need to satisfy your...
What is the recommended daily allowance? Yeah.
I mean, all you need to say is, I ate some of his pan-fried penis.
Nobody's going to be like, oh yeah, how much?
How much, right? 8 ounces? 4 ounces?
How many slices of Hemingway bologna? He had a larger group, but he served them a rattlesnake or something like that. Crocodile, some other exotic meat. Like, yeah. Maybe a snake.
I don't think that in the family of exotic meats, it goes crocodile, armadillo, man's penis.
What comes after that?
I feel like
manatee.
I feel like man's penis is way, way, way out on the spectrum.
You feel like man's penis is way, way out on the spectrum.
Especially if
that's for Omnibus Out of Context.
If the especially if your waiter and cook are the man who has put,
you're gonna have to make eye contact with the owner of the scrotum you're tucking into.
So this is the example of cannibalism you're describing. It's not that he served humans at the festival.
Yeah, I mean, cannibalism doesn't imply that the person has to be dead, right? You can, I
guess not.
You can cut off your arm and
eat it.
You're still a cannibal.
Sure,
right?
I guess that's right.
You know, America being a frontier country, most of our cases, most recent cases of cannibalism in the news tend to be related to some kind of disaster, a shipwreck, or a rugby plane crash, the worst kind of plane crash. There were a lot of World War II, you know, in Europe, a lot of World War II era privations. The sieges of Leningrad and Stalingrad led to documented cases of people having to use the frozen dead as a food source. The most famous ones in American history are cases of the West.
Right.
Presumably because, I don't know, the kind of I don't need your rules kind of soul that heads west also doesn't mind cannibalism taboos.
Well, or I also think that the story of the American West is a lot of city folk from back east coming west and not having the skills. I mean, it's the Christopher McCandless problem,
right?
If he had the skills, he could have survived a winter in Alaska, or he especially could have survived a summer in Alaska, because people do it all the time that have the skills.
The movie would have been boring, though.
Well, yeah, that's right. Oh, you know, the movie would have been like Revenant or whatever. Just Leonardo DiCaprio killing bears.
He just beats up a bear and heads on back to civilization. Hey, I killed a bear.
But that's kind of the confusing part about a lot of these Western cannibalism stories, because my understanding is that if you have fresh water, you can go without food for 2 months.
Yeah, it's more than a month, I think.
You know, McCandless lived for 3.5 months out there, but he was also eating stuff. Seeds and birds, and I mean, he had a gun. You could kill a squirrel and roast it. He just didn't like work out kind of the basics. Like he killed a moose and didn't know how to smoke the meat. Like
I wouldn't know how to smoke the meat.
But like if you're try and smoke a smaller thing first before a moose.
I just think it's easy for us to say that, and you have to imagine the 10 tasks you have to get right to get to the point where you're smoking a squirrel, perfect it, move on to a rabbit.
It's true, but by the same token, it's an ancient practice that was, yeah, sure, handed down from mother cat to her kittens.
But you're right, but they all figured it out.
They all figured it out, right? You have to build a tent, and you light a fire, and you put the thing in there and hope that it worked, right? And you do it until it does work. So survival is a thing that humans have managed since that we first came down from the trees, Ken.
Yeah, when did you think we first managed survival?
Let's see.
Very early on.
At some point early on, we started to learn how to survive. So I'm always confused. Like, if your plane crashes in the Andes, I don't know how long they were there. How, you know, the Donner Party had to survive winter.
Before the team started eating each other?
Yeah.
Weirdly, it was like 10 minutes.
Yeah, it seems to me like it's...
We call those locker room problems.
Yeah.
It's in the sports world.
I get that it would be hard. I just am never sure at what point I would stop chasing squirrels and start coveting my neighbor's buttock.
Pie.
Yeah.
Have you ever been on Colorado University? Do you know the dining hall?
At the University of Colorado?
Yeah.
I've eaten there.
At Alfred Packer Dining Hall?
Yeah.
Named for the famed Colorado cannibal who, you know, wandered out of the mountains one day and everyone said, hey, where's the rest of your party? And he was like, oh, yeah, I don't know. Things just really went wrong. And
lost along the way.
He's rubbing his tummy as he says it, suspiciously. You know, the most famous of these cases, of course, in American history is the Donner Party. Because yes. Because the cannibalism is really just it's really the icing on the cake.
Yeah, that was as we say, a cluster F.
It's a crazy story, you know, even without the fact that half the survivors eventually had to resort to eating some of the other non-survivors. It actually should have been called the Donner-Reed Party. In fact, it was originally called the Donner-Reed Party, like the Donner-Reed Show, I guess.
Uh-huh. Donner-Reed.
Because George Donner was one of the leaders of the party, but James Frazier Reed... was also one of its founders, and his name has not come down to us.
Is it because he got eaten?
He did not. See, that's what's interesting. He is one of the most, he's the most fascinating part of the Donner Party story to me, and he has a second act. You know, famously, no second acts in American Lives. But
he came back and became a rap artist?
This is, exactly. This is some guy where the Donner Party was not the end of his story. He was an American, and the reason why James Frazier Reed, by the way, is the subject of this entry is because it was a request from a listener. Axel donated to the Patreon at the Washing Bear tier and requested James Frazier Reed as a subject.
Well done, Axel.
For reasons of his own.
Maybe Axel is descendant from James Frazier Reed.
It's quite possible.
Because he survived and presumably
spoilers,
reproduced.
He does reproduce. Yes. He reproduces avidly. He was an Irish immigrant. He was born around 1800 and came to America with his widowed mother in the early 19th century. And by the 1840s, he's doing well for himself. He's a prosperous farmer and furniture dealer in Springfield, Illinois. He's got a sawmill of his own, and you know the wood goes into his furniture. He's got a wife and four young children, but He is not quiet in his soul.
Boy, isn't that the way? I mean, I used to be a farmer and a grocer in Illinois, and I couldn't.
You had a sawmill.
I couldn't hack it.
Was it because the West was calling you?
It was. The West was calling.
I mean, that's what happened in the 1840s.
What am I, some kind of farmer and grocer? No.
I mean, in his case, it really does seem like a midlife crisis. You don't think of the Oregon Trail as a midlife crisis option, but back then, maybe a lot of people who were like, well, I mean, this is everything I've always wanted, and yet...
They didn't have Corvettes yet. Or, I mean, they did. They were just ships of war.
What if people bought a Corvette ship back then?
Like, I'm just so restless. I'm going to buy a Corvette.
I'm going to rebuild a Mustang, but like an actual horse. This seems to be the case. His case. He's in his mid-40s and everything's turning up James Frazier Reed, and he still thinks, boy, over those hills.
You're in your mid-40s.
Yeah, but I'm already living in the Pacific Northwest. Where would I go? Alaska, I guess.
Alaska.
I've never been tempted to pick up steaks and leave.
Human steaks?
I've never been tempted
to pick up a delicious human steak
and grill it
at the Whole Foods.
So with another local named George Donner, George and Jacob Donner, his friends who are brothers, he decides to leave everything behind and get his family out west, where he can't even say it's a prosperity or a second chance because he's doing great and he's in Springfield, Illinois in the 1840s. That is the frontier.
He could have been president of the United States.
He's done it.
What? He was president of the United States?
No, he's achieved the American dream.
Yeah, sure.
There is going to be a near American president in our story. But
he's on the frontier.
He's,
Tippecanoe and Tyler too.
He's living the life. But California called back then. And so he and his friends, the Donners, hop in their covered wagons, previously covered on omnibus. That's why they're covered wagons, because we covered them already.
Are you going to San Francisco?
He is not going to San Francisco, but he does know the way to San Jose.
Oh, okay.
It turns out.
All right. A little bit south of there.
One thing you might not know about the Donner Party is it had one very fancy midlife crisis vehicle in it. James Frazier Reed's wife, Margaret, was prone to headaches.
Okay.
Maybe this is part of his midlife crisis.
Sure, it's why he wants to go to California. His get away from his shrew.
His invalid wife that he doesn't understand. So he builds for her a fantastic double-decker covered wagon.
Hot tamales.
With spring-loaded, kind of shock absorber, spring-loaded seats to try to keep his wife's migraines at bay.
Oh, how thoughtful.
Like a real gourmet, a supply of good liquor. He was going to live well on the way west. And everybody in the group called it the palace car because it was the biggest and most luxurious vehicle that anybody had ever tried to take from the eastern United States into the west at that time.
In retrospect, he wishes he'd brought more sacks of beans.
Yes.
Fewer bottles of gin and
less single malt.
More hardtack.
That's exactly right. So he's over the course of the expedition, he comes to be recognized as a capable man and a leader, but he's also, as we'll see, a little hot-headed and prone to some bad decisions. The palace car is one of them because it really slows down their progress, which means when they arrive at Fort Laramie have to tackle the Rockies, have to tackle the mountains between them and California, they are later than they should have been. And he also makes the mistake of believing a guidebook writer named Lanford Hastings.
Mm, never believe Lanford Hastings.
A name like Lanford Hastings, he really does seem like a Harold Hill type shyster, right?
He does. I feel like he's got a bowler hat on a little twisty handle, and he's like, step right up, Lanford Hastings.
Hastings has come back east and has told everybody, look, if you're going to the Oregon Trail, yeah, you want to head up towards Fort Bridger. But if you're going to California,
you take the Hastings cutoff.
You take the Hastings cutoff, which means you go around the south side of the Great Salt Lake instead of around the north.
What? I can tell you right now that's not the right way.
What would be the downsides of going around the south side of the Great Salt Lake?
Because you hit those dumb mountains in Nevada that you can't get over.
Well, even before then, you hit the salt flats.
Oh, right. Of course. You're going to get run down by some hot rod.
But, right. But did I tell you when we were out there driving around the salt flats last time we were there?
You can just haul ass out on salt flats.
So we had the kids, Caitlin's or did Caitlin get to drive? I can't remember if both the kids drove. We had two unlicensed kids driving a Honda Odyssey.
As fast as they could?
Yeah. There was still salt on the underside of that car until we traded it in years later.
I was test driving some cars this weekend because my family now insists that I buy a car that isn't from the 1970s.
You're finally a grown-up.
And I was noticing that most cars are geared in such a way now as to make you feel like you're going fast when you're not. But I was test driving a couple of American cars that were still geared in the old fashioned way, which is to try and make you feel like you're not going fast when you are. And at one point I looked down and I was going 110 miles an hour or something on the freeway and just didn't feel like it. And then I got back into the regular car that also doesn't belong to me, but is part of my family retinue of cars. And we were driving 70 miles an hour and I just felt like I was going like a bullet. And it's all about the way cars are just, I don't know, geared and insulated.
Our new car has a controversial new manufacturer-installed top speed limit.
Oh, nanny state.
They've put the nanny state, in this case, Sweden, has put a 112 mile per hour limit on its entire vehicle line as kind of a nod to, I don't know if it's safety or saving the earth or both.
Sure, both.
I mean, I don't know what difference I'm making. You know, when I used to go 113 on the highway, the glaciers were receding. But now that I can only go 112, things seem okay.
Now, the Volvo is the cauliflower pasta of the auto industry.
And it really did convert me. I was like, yeah.
112. I'm fine with that.
I'm okay now. I guess I'm not an American anymore. I'm an honorary Swede. But James Frazier Reed, I guess, is kind of he's kind of the forerunner of the 50s road trip dad who has read the guidebook, and he persuades the group that the Hastings cutoff is the way to go. Even though at Fort Laramie, he meets a friend or somebody he knows from Illinois coming back from the West, coming back from Oregon or California, who tells him, oh no, you can't take wagons that way. That's just not going to work. I've been that way. There's no trail there. And he's like, ah, yeah, what a jokester, you know?
And how much time does he expect to save via the Hastings cutoff relative to just the regular path?
You're supposed to say it is quicker. It's less distance covered. And in theory, you could save 3 weeks.
Whoa. That's a lot. If you're behind schedule at Fort Laramie.
Big deal. And I think that's what makes the difference, and that's what allows him to persuade the men. Unfortunately, there's no trail there. There is no Hastings cutoff. As they head south into the salt flats, well, first of all, it's not navigable. They end up having to cut down trees just to, you know, get the wagons through.
Get them to the salt flats.
Right. And once they get there, they get endlessly bogged down in the salt flats. And instead of saving them 3 weeks, the Hastings cutoff, which is what I call it when I serve my penis at a dinner party.
Yes.
Ends up costing them over a month, 5 weeks lost. So it's a, you know, 8 week swing.
Boo.
So really, futurelings,
stay on the path.
That's the one thing we want to tell you. If you see the Hastings cutoff, stay far away.
Stay on the straight and narrow.
They get to the Humboldt River in central Nevada. It's already October. They're not even ascending, you know, the steep eastern climb into the Sierras.
There's not a ton of like fresh fruit around the Humboldt River in central Nevada.
That's exactly what's happening. Supplies are running low. It's still murderously hot. They have this ticking clock they know of getting snowed in before they get to California.
And you can't just go to Reno or to...
You can't get $1.99 steak and eggs like you could today if you're hungry around Truckee. And this is where the inciting incident happens. A teamster named, they're trying to get up a sandy slope, and the oxen are having a hard time, particularly, I assume, the ones trying to pull this crazy double-decker palace car. He invented the Winnebago, I think, basically.
Yeah, right.
And another teamster named John Snyder turns his whip handle onto James Frazier Reed's oxen.
Oh.
And just starts
whipping him,
bashing him with the whip handle to try to get him up the slope.
James Frazier Reed, not into somebody whipping his ox.
Not in
whip your own ox.
Is that a euphemism?
Yeah.
He protests and I think pulls a knife to threaten Snyder.
Oh dear.
In which case Snyder turns the whip handle on him, and in some accounts on his wife Margaret as well.
Oh boy, Snyder's really.
And as a result, Reed stabs him in the chest multiple times, and then a half hour later, he's dead. This stops forward progress for a while as the party tries to decide. I mean, this is really, speaking of locker room problems,
yeah,
this is the kind of thing that'll really bum out an expedition through Nevada. You've been on a road trip through Nevada. Tempers can run high.
I have.
Somebody kills somebody else with a knife, it's going to get even stickier.
Ken, we haven't talked for a while about omnibus t-shirts and merch, a thing that I'm super proud of, and I know you are too.
I'm really excited about these new June shirt designs. I just got an email from someone who missed the mail truck shirt.
One of the great shirts.
Back when we first offered it. And this person should be delighted to hear that both shirts in January are mail truck options. They are gray t-shirts for those who didn't want black or white.
January? You said January.
Did I say January?
Yeah.
I meant June, which is January in the Southern Hemisphere.
There you go. That's right. It's the June of January.
It's the January of summer, yeah. I always say.
So both June shirts, you're saying, are mail truck shirts.
Yes. And here's the deal. One of them is an old Grumman LLV driven by Mr. Zip himself, gray with the omnibus logo in blue. But then the sparkly new one is one of these new next generation fleet of mail trucks, with a cool, sexy 21st century Mr. Zip driving and the omnibus logo in red. And they both look pretty great.
How cool are they? I love them both. And
they're in kind of fun mid-century modern style, like something straight out of The Incredibles 2, that movie that the kids love.
Yeah, they invoke the great history of mail trucks. And as you know, the way that fan communities operate, the mail truck is now synonymous with omnibus.
Which was genius of us because as a quasi-federal organization, they can't complain.
Yeah, right. I mean, although when the Postal Service band came out with their smash hit single, Such Great Heights, they actually were confronted by the Postal Service, who insisted—
Who said you can't call a band the Postal Service?
Yeah, well, what they did was they said, we'll let you— call your band the Postal Service if you do some ads for the Postal Service. There was some kind of friendly tit for tat.
Well, you know what? We would do ads for the Postal Service if that would let us sell mail truck shirts.
We support the Postal Service. So buy the mail truck shirt and precipitate whatever confrontation we're going to have with the U.S. Postal Service, and let's get this ball rolling.
If you missed out on the mail truck shirt the first time or want to see these new designs, just head to omnibusproject.com/store, and you can see not only shirts, but all the other mugs and hats and whatnot that we have to offer. Thanks to our friends at Mediocrity for putting out these two new shirt designs. They're going to be on sale for all of June, but then they won't be anymore. So act now.
Act now. Get those shirts. You know, my bass player was... before I hired him in the band, he was a FedEx driver, but he was in his early 20s and didn't know anything. And
he knew how to turn right, and that's it.
Somebody at FedEx had taught him to pump his brakes going downhill or something. He had it in his mind that in order to save your brakes going downhill, that you would pump them. And we were outside of Winnemucca coming down the big hill. And I'm in the back fast asleep, and I wake up to the feeling of the van.
The beat dropping?
Just like pumping. And I was like, what are you doing? And he was like, pumping the brakes. And I was like, why? You know, it's a sunny day, bright sunny day. And he was like, oh, you know, it's what you do on a downhill. And I was like, it's not what you do on a downhill. And I almost stabbed him. Right in the chest.
Did he turn a whip handle on you?
Nope, he wouldn't have dared.
I don't know. What is a bassist equivalent of a whip handle?
Yeah, the low E string. I made him pull over and get out, and we had a big row.
Well, then you can exactly understand what happened to the Donna Reed party here.
Yes.
And this is the point at which they stop being the Donna Reed party. Snyder was very popular. Reed, despite being a leader of the expedition, was kind of a hot-headed guy who had already made a couple bad calls and was not well-liked.
Well, he had this ridiculous
And he had this fancy limo
too.
That they couldn't even get up the hill.
Yeah.
So there's discussion of what do? Do they hang him?
All right.
Do they just let it go and keep going? Finally, they you know, this being America, they go for the compromise middle way, and they decide to banish him.
Elect him to the U.S. Congress.
Yes. They decide to banish him from the expedition.
Oh, okay, sure. Just him, or does he have, like, does he have some minions?
His wife and kids stay. He doesn't have any other really allies in the expedition. So his wife and kids stay with the expedition, but he is told to ride on ahead with his horse, leaving his family in the palace.
Just the man?
Just him.
Wow. Okay.
I assume they don't know what his chances of survival are, and they don't want to condemn her to the same fate, or they know that the wagon can't make it. Unfortunately, as if you know the story of the Donner Party, you know, riding on ahead in a horse is actually where you want to be.
That's right. That was the better verse.
That was the way to go. Cause they were late and the snows came early. They got up to Donner Pass, in an amazing coincidence. The Donner Party.
So weird.
Crossed the Sierras at Donner Pass.
I wonder that all the time. How is that possible?
You can tell why they made for it. They're like, this has got to be a good omen. If it were the Donner Reed Pass, that would be better. But I don't think it had a name back then. I was trying to find out what the Donner Pass was called before it was the Donner Pass.
Probably had a Native American name that no one bothered to record.
It had a beautiful, poetic, indigenous name that everyone who knew is now lost. Sorry. So he gets ahead of the, you know, he crosses at Donner Summit.
Right.
Where you can cross today. If you've ever taken I-80 across America, that's how you get into California. And
he got across and got on with his life, found a new wife,
new wife, new four kids. That's what California does for you. That's what a midlife crisis is. No, he beat the snow by a few days. They missed it by just a few days. And so he finds himself in the beginnings of civilization. You know, he arrives
Grass Valley.
Placerville. I guess he gets to Sutter's Fort, which was then kind of the first bit of civilization. And the snows have come to the mountains.
What year is this, BT Dubs?
1846.
So
Sutter is just
right. Sutter's just a little old fella sitting there.
He's two or three years away from being news coast to coast. Right now, I'm sure he has a mill.
He's got a mill, right?
But nothing's going on there. And cutting down
trees.
He's at his fort. And he immediately gets supplies and he immediately heads back up to try to rescue the party, seeing that snow has come. He can't get through. His trip is blocked just 12 miles from Emigrant Gap.
So he's not mad about being ostracized because he's got his wife and kids still there. And he's like, I got to get back. I got to help him out.
He is terribly worried about his family, and rightly so. They are in most likely lethal situation, trapped in the Sierras over the winter.
Would they have called it a pickle then, or is that a more recent coinage?
I think they would have said it was a real pickle.
A real pickle.
But it was a swear back then. You couldn't say the P word.
Right. Well, that's a real P word.
If you know what I mean. The ladies would have to say pibble or puddle or something. They'd have to mince the oath. So he gets back to Sutter's Fort trying to get a rescue party together, and is told, yeah, look at the mountains. That's until February. There is no getting back up there.
Oh, so the guys sitting around Sutter's Fort are too chicken to go up and help these people. Is that what they knew about them? I always thought the Donner Party, the problem was that nobody knew they were there.
No, everybody knew they were there, and they were just like, hey, what are you going to do? They're way over there.
Wow. Anybody hear of snowshoes?
Not a lot of options at Sutter's Fort. And here's the complicating factor. They get a telegraph from the president saying, Mr. Sutter, the Mexican-American War has just begun. Let's have the Mexican-American War. California is now a military theater. Because, you know, we say these people are heading to California, but what we really should say is they're heading to North Mexico.
Right.
Which is what California was at the time. And the Californios are getting more and more annoyed at the Anglo settlers pouring in. People like Donner and Reed with West Coast fever.
Right.
And they don't
know our local ways.
It becomes a full-fledged war. And
this is a side of the Donner story I wasn't aware of either. They're fighting down in Sacramento?
Well, there was actually fighting in Northern California, as we will see. But Sutter says, look, there's no men here. Everybody here is being, all the soldiers that are normally quartered here are being sent south to fight the war. What you need to do is to head on to Yerba Buena, like go out to the San Francisco Bay
right.
and talk to the uh, commandant there, maybe he has men to spare.
Sure. A lot of guys just sitting around.
just like Silicon Valley today.
That's right. A lot of guys in the mission just driving up rents.
A lot of guys playing foosball and eating free breakfast cereal at work. So Reed gets a horse, sets out for a little mission called San Jose. Uh-huh. It turns out he does know the way.
Turn left at Albuquerque.
He arrives there, and by the way, the person running the fort is Colonel John C. Fremont.
I knew that.
Who is
Fremont, California?
Sure.
That's why they call it that.
Is the Fremont neighborhood of Seattle named for Fremont? I assume
different,
so.
No, different
Fremont. Are you sure? Because he became a national figure. He becomes the first Republican presidential candidate in 1852, I want to say.
It's the same Fremont.
Oh, is it?
I don't know. I'm going to look it up. Fremont, Washington. Let's see what it says. I'm sure the first thing it says is it's a nuclear free zone. It is named after Fremont, Nebraska.
Which in turn...
The hometown of two of its founders. Fremont, Nebraska is home of Midland University. And Fremont was named after John C. Fremont. Wow.
Because Fremont, Nebraska was on the Mormon Trail.
It's Fremont, Nebraska's all the way down.
I mean, even though he is not yet a presidential candidate, he is one of the most famous explorers of the American. Can you imagine? You get to the fort to try to... This is like when the airplane shows up to rescue you and it's Harrison Ford flying the plane. He gets to the fort and it's John C. Fremont himself who says, "Sorry, buddy. All my men are heading south to fight the Battle of Santa Barbara."
Right.
Which, yeah, it's kind of funny. You read about the Mexican-American War in California, and all the battles are named after these really nice, chill places. Do you think they had headed up and had the Battle of Pismo Beach after?
they're up like the Battle of Napa, the Battle of Sonoma.
The Battle of Malibu. In fact, by the time our man, Mr. Reed, gets to San Jose, the fighting has reached Northern California. He's recruited. And while he is anguishing over his family, he fights in the Battle of Santa Clara, the only battle of the Mexican-American War that happened in Northern California.
I mean, you can kind of see where you'd be worried about your family and you're like, can we get this war over with? And it would make you maybe an impassioned fighter because you're like, yes, okay, die, die, die. Like,
the sooner we get done with the Battle of Santa Clara, maybe some of these bozos will come help me rescue my family in the Sierras.
Exactly.
And that's what happens. After the battle, he's got new military connections. He's able to finagle together a relief expedition.
And this is what month now?
He and his men get up to Donner Lake, again, the fortuitously named Donner Lake, by late February.
Oh, boy.
And I believe he is the first one to reach... four relief parties get up there. But I think he is the first one to reach the stragglers of the Donner Party. And he finds there are still 47 survivors left, roughly half of those who set out from Illinois. His wife and his four children are all alive.
Whoa.
Presumably they were.
They just were hiding on the second story.
They were hiding away the good stuff, the secret food in their palace car. Yeah. I don't know which of his family actually was emaciated enough to turn to cannibalism. The funny part is his rescue party actually got snowed in on the way out, trying to get word back that he had found the Donner Party, and a second rescue party had to come in and rescue his rescue party.
Is it the case that some members of the Donner Party survived without resorting to cannibalism? The cannibalism was just like a thing that some of the people got into?
There were like kind of two different cliques that were into different things.
Because it seems like that would discredit the cannibalism. If it wasn't strictly necessary.
Maybe there was only enough food for, say, 20 people to survive. And so that means the other 25 had to turn to cannibalism.
But it seems like if you were doing it right, everybody would get an equal share of the food until it ran out. You wouldn't have like, well, there's only enough food for 20 of us, so...
Who wants to be a cannibal? Maybe there were some people who were eager to...
who were more into it. That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah, some people are volunteering even before there's... I mean, it's the cannibalism that makes this a celebrated case from coast to coast.
Right.
Because, you know, pioneer family getting trapped in the mountains, that was happening all the time. And
sure.
Often word didn't get any further than Fort right. Sutter's Fort.
Space Ghost, also a big thing, but not yet coast to coast.
But in this case, the lurid details are exaggerated in all the press and all the big magazines.
You're saying that the cannibalism was not as big a deal as it was made out to be?
Why do we always talk about the cannibalism? There's other cool things about the Donner Party. They played a lot of Uno.
Yeah, they think about all the songs they wrote.
And so the snow melts. Reed's family has all survived, and the Reeds are happy to enter California and begin their new lives.
Now, and Reed himself, his reputation is not besmirched as it would have been were he to have been one of the cannibals. Isn't the cannibalism a thing that like kept some of these people from eventually running for governor?
And the cannibalism is actually very fortuitous for him because it erases all memory of
his murder
of John Snyder. I mean, this guy just stabbed a fellow party member in the chest, and now that's like the least interesting thing,
right,
about the expedition. So if you're gonna murder a coworker, you know, do it in a place that's about to have some massive OSHA violation or something.
Well, hang on, let me write that down.
Yeah, it's good advice.
Yeah, okay,
it's good advice. If you ever find a stranger in the Alps,
I mean, I don't have that many coworkers, present company accepted, but.
Now, unlike everybody else, the other difference between him and everybody in the Donner Party is he has had a taste of California. And in particular, he has fallen in love with the South Bay. He loves San Jose.
Wow.
I mean, even though he went there in a panic to try to get relief together to save his dying family and ended up having to fight Mexicans.
Right.
He was like, you know what? This is a nice place to settle down after all this.
One infinite loop has really good high-speed internet.
Yeah, exactly. There's fiber. There's fiber internet.
He went to West Palo Alto, but not East Palo Alto.
I mean, imagine San Jose back then is very different. You know, there was a mission there.
Right.
But all the orchards that the Padres had planted have kind of been abandoned and overgrown. But he's a canny Illinois farmer that can tell, hey, this is really good bottom soil.
Sure.
These fruit trees are just ready to come back. Yeah, he's got sawmill / furniture store owner / farmer expertise.
Right.
And he arrives at the perfect time because, spoilers, the United States wins the Mexican War.
Oh, wait a minute. I wish I'd known that before I bought all these shares in Mexico.
And suddenly, there is a power vacuum there because all the wealthy Mexican alcaldes that used to run the place in the Zorro days have had to head south,
right?
For their, you know, because the new Anglo settlers are kicking everybody out, and there's a new kind of system of regidores, like commissioners that are going to run the area. So he runs for regidor, and he wins. So he's one of the town fathers of San Jose. He
builds a two-story farmhouse
that looks like his Conestoga wagon. No, but he does lease all these orchards that haven't been producing any fruit. And suddenly he has a bumper crop of everything you can grow in this amazing Mediterranean climate, figs and quince and apples. And for his dried fruit, gets a bunch of sugar and cocoa and coffee and rice back. So now he's a Pacific merchant,
right?
Rising, up and coming. He and his family, by the way, they're all still living in tents in the orchards while they pick this stuff. Because San Jose is not a town yet.
Right.
But finally, they do move down into the pueblo, into kind of this one-room adobe with a dirt floor and a leather, you know, just an oxhide hanging over the door. Their fifth child is born. You know, he's in on the ground floor.
These are the salad days.
He's in on the ground floor of what seems to be a burgeoning new life. And then...
Aren't his wife and children super traumatized and full of PTSD and waking up in the middle of the night with nightmares? And
the story doesn't recall because they are women and children.
I see.
And 19th century history is totally unconcerned. But yeah, like
I'm surprised I even cared.
A version of this... it seems a little out of character for you. But yeah, imagine a version of this that actually talks about the migraine...
Right, the wife waking up screaming.
Emaciated, headachy wife getting out of the Sierra, only to find her husband being like, I have found the most amazing pear trees. You've got it. It's like the most annoying midlife crisis in history. But then, you know, even while things are already turning up great for them, in 1848, as you have foreshadowed, gold is discovered not far away.
Right up there where they already know the people. Good old Sutter.
So he heads back for Placerville in the Sierras, where he's been before.
What probably wasn't named And I would say Placerville. Do you say Placerville?
Is it Placerville?
That's what
I guess say. I've never had to say it. I've only seen it on as a guide city on interstate signs.
It was not named that prior to this.
No, it still would have been. But Emigrant Gap would have been called Emigrant Gap. Right. He heads up towards Emigrant Gap.
Let's call it that.
What would become
Placerville.
Who knows what Vowelville. It's Placerville, huh?
That's what I would say. It's the gold is called Placer. The type of gold.
Oh, is that why you know there's a specific type of gold?
Yeah, it's a placer mine is the kind of mine that would, so placer is like the gold that's down in the sand at the bottom of a stream. So it's not a vein of gold, it's placer gold, which is gold that's been weathered down and is in gravel.
Well, as you've given away, he has happened to find a great place to pan for gold. Rich diggings,
as the
prospectors would say. Yeah, I don't know why they didn't call it that. Pay dirtville.
Uh-huh.
I guess our expression, you know, to strike pay dirt, literally comes from
this dirt,
finding dirt that would pay your way.
Yeah.
So he comes home the following year with his saddlebags literally bulging with gold.
He's got orchards full of pears and sugarcane, bags full of gold.
He was an early adopter, you know, because this is the same year that, you know, President Polk announces to America, the gold rush has begun, in his State of the Union address. Really, the only good State of the Union address ever,
mm-hmm.
was President Polk saying, I've decided to have the California gold rush.
Ich bin ein California gold rush.
And everybody hated when he said, I decided to have the Mexican-American War, but now everyone races for California.
Right.
And just through an accident of geography, Reed is already there. And by the time...
And already pear.
And full of pears and figs and quince. He had a lot more quince than most men of this time.
You know, I was at a restaurant in Southern California one time. One of those restaurants that had an atomic theme and all the waitresses were 70 years old.
Like it's a diner?
Yeah, a diner. The kind of diner that only exists in L.A.
Yeah.
And their specialty was quince pie.
Really?
And I was like, quince pie? And the waitress was like, oh, you know, she's smacking her gum and she had three pens in her bun. And she said, oh, it's our specialty. You're going to love it. And I was like, quince pie? And she was like, you got to get it. And I got it. I got the quince pie at her recommendation. It was the worst thing I'd ever had in my life.
Well, quince is it's just a sour pear.
Yeah.
If you candy up the juice, you can make some, I've had there's a Spanish candy called membrillo, which is just kind of a jelly-like candy you make with quince juice.
I mean, you can make brandy out of anything, but I don't think you can make pie out of anything.
I mean, they make pie out of rhubarb, which is basically just an inedible stem.
But they put the rhubarb with other stuff. Yeah,
just tasted like...
It just was like tasted like sour pears. And I was like, I'm sure they put a bunch of sugar in it, but not enough to make it not taste like sour pears. Anyway, I don't recommend it.
Anyway, by the time every aimless American man and ne'er-do-well under 30,
including all of my ancestors,
have arrived
and yours probably
have arrived in Northern California, Reed, who only had to travel from San Jose, has gotten the money and gotten out.
Yes, that's the way to do it.
And
gold
he
rush.
Now has, and he still is a believer in San Jose. You know, he kind of sees, he's going to use his new bonanza to create a new town. He has a vision of it as just perhaps the state capital someday, just a thriving commercial center.
Yeah.
So he goes to one of these old land grant families and buys a full square mile of open acreage near the Plaza of the Pueblo and, you know, builds himself a big adobe ranch house and plants wheat. But then he has his genius idea because he knows what Sutter has done. He knows what John Sutter did out by the Sacramento River. He is going to subdivide it into lots.
Oh, very nice. Except not gold lots. He's subdividing it into tract home lots.
Exactly. He's going to create neighborhoods with farms and gardens.
Yes.
He's decided to get into real estate.
God bless him.
And this makes him essentially, you know, the richest man in California over the following decade. He's a you know, he's the local celebrity. He's, right. You know, when a sea captain comes in with $1,000 rosewood piano that he's trying to unload, it is
because James, he brought it on the ship for his migrainy wife.
I can only assume. James Reed says $1,000. Sure. You know, paying what is probably some 5 or 6 figure amount of money today,
right,
for the nicest piano in the West, literally sets it up in his parlor. You know, as families flood into this newly blossoming part of the world, he and his family are a little bit of civilization.
And is the Donner connection, does the tangential Donner connection add to his fame, or is it something that he hopes no one will mention? Is he,
people know it.
But they also know he wasn't a people eater, but was his wife a people eater?
Well, I think you just have to deal with the fact that anybody who got there early enough was a people eater. Like, it's really a mark of his, of being one of the Brahmins and the, oh, the old good families, that they were in the Donner Party.
Sure.
You know, they were like, they were the first families in Northern California.
The same way that the first families in New England can all claim to be witch burners.
Right.
The first,
how many witches did your ancestors burn?
Right.
So when it comes time for a constitutional convention,
which it always does,
when California is becoming a state, Reed shows up and says, easy, no problem. I got the capital for you right here. Beautiful San Jose. There's going to be a state house. There's going to be a plaza. And he promises that he's going to have a place for the legislature to meet. He gets the votes, and the what will be the California state legislature first convenes in San Jose, California.
Oh.
Unfortunately, he didn't actually have any of the stuff he was promising. He had not actually built a state house.
Oh, he claimed to have built a state
house. Well, he said, oh, it'll be there. You know, it's like bidding for the Olympics.
I see.
We're going to have a big polo field. There's going to be a dome for the gymnastics. There's going to be another aquatic center.
Yeah, Tempelhof, the whole thing.
And I'm sure he meant it every word. But by the time the legislators showed up, really all there was just seas of goopy mud and a half-finished... you know, he had taken this two-story adobe building that was going to be a hotel and bought it for a song and was going to turn it into a legislature. And on December 15th, the legislators show up and it's not ready to occupy. So
maybe I should have turned my house that's been a sea of goopy mud all these months into a legislature.
Did you think of moving the Washington State Legislature?
That's into the thing. Your... It hadn't occurred to me, and I think it might have been it would have been a financially better.
Well, the legislators were not into it because there was not enough rooms in town for them to stay. There was nowhere for them to convene. Again, it's all mud and rain. Everybody's sleeping on dining room floors or spare bedrooms. I mean, it was California. It was the Bay Area in the winter.
I mean, that's the Bay Area in the winter that I know even to this day. Everybody's sleeping on benches and floors in restaurants.
I mean, and the previous year, when they were still meeting in the old Mexican capital of, do you know what the capital of California was under the Californios?
It was, yes, I do. I do know it was...
It was
San Juan de Capistrano.
Yeah, actually, you're close. Yeah. I mean, it was Monterey.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so
Monterey, of course.
And that they would have in the previous year, they were also just, you know, in tents and stuff down there as well. So it's not like they were used to a fine domed building. But
I'm sure that's what he said at the time too. It's not like you guys are used to a fine domed building.
But he's saying, look, San Jose is still the future. Don't worry. I'm going to donate, he donates like fully 4 city blocks, and 168 more town lots, you know, there's space to build all the buildings that a state government would need. All the other big San Jose gold and fruit money, empties their pockets as well. Unfortunately, as you and I know, San Jose is not the capital of California in our timeline.
Who made a better offer for SACTO?
One General Mariano Vallejo.
Oh, the old general, they called him.
Yes. He was the comandante back in the Mexican days, and he owned more land than all the gringos combined.
Take that, gringos.
And he thought there should be a town named for him. If you've ever driven through Vallejo, you know that he got his wish.
I do.
And it has a Best Buy and a In-N-Out. And so he offers more money, more acres, and San Jose cannot top it. And when the legislature has to vote the following year, the capital moves from San Jose to Vallejo in 1852. And then it kind of jumps around a bit. It goes to San Jose again. Benicia finally winds up in Sacramento in 1854. And Reed, due to some slow construction and rainy weather, lost out on his chance to host the state capitol.
But he didn't lose out, right? No, Reed never went bankrupt.
Fine. No, he was still always, you know, this is a story of the rare second act where, you know, this guy who had a disastrous, murderous journey west in an attempt to reinvent himself actually figured it out and became one of the great success stories of his time.
But in a way, it's also a story of a rich guy who, like, drove a limo across the country, got away with murdering a guy, and then became a war hero and a real estate magnate and a like a pumpernickel supply guy.
It's definitely a story of someone who had a lot of advantages and then accidentally happened to be in the right place at the right time, just taking over an entire geographic locale and almost a state, within a whisker of taking over a whole state. And I'm sure thinking it was all because of his own internal merits and the goodness of God.
He was born on third and thought he hit a triple.
In the end, he ends up deeding fully 115 lots and 5 town squares of just prime downtown San Jose Pueblo land to the city. To this day, those are the city of San Jose's nicest parks and the campus of San Jose State University.
So the city didn't turn around and profit from selling them on the secondary market. It actually is part of what makes San Jose nice.
Maybe some. Ah. Maybe some, but there's some nice-ish. Hey, there could be...
Lol.
What's the demonym? There could be San Joseans. Yeah, that's right.
San Joseans.
San Hosers. Listening right now.
We know for a fact there are.
I mean, that's probably Silicon Valley is obviously going to be the center of human achievement in the far future, because that's where the first sentient machines will appear.
Right. That's where futurelings see their origin story, San Jose.
Right. It's their Bethlehem, basically. Whatever the computer messiah is that's about to rise out of a server farm in Mountain View or Cupertino. To this day, there's a Reed's Addition is a, you know, nice neighborhood of central San Jose. And his family ended up being prosperous residents of the region for over a century.
Why is there no Reedston?
Yeah, exactly. I guess he's not a ego tripping.
Oh, he definitely doesn't sound
narcissist like Mariano Vallejo. But you know, as recently as you know, the old, if you talk to an old San Jose hand, the old sporting goods store that everybody went to was Reed's Sporting Good until it closed in 2008, and it was named for an entrepreneur grandson of town father James Fraser Reed.
I remember Reed's Sporting Goods.
Well, if you bought there, you're complicit then in this silver spoon, born on third base, midlife crisis guy just murdering his way across the West, avoiding cannibalism really only by murder, and then lucking into a second fortune. It's always these overconfident white guys who land on their feet.
I did not buy there because I knew enough of this story to go up to the shopping cart or to go up to the checkout with my cart full of freeze-dried fettuccine Alfredo and, self-nesting metal pans. And then I banged the pans together and I staged a protest against genocide and then stomped out without buying a single thing.
Reed Sporting Goods, home of the double-decker shopping cart.
And that concludes James Fraser Reed, entry 1044.EZ0510, certificate number 51638 in the omnibus. Futurelings, in the unlikely event that you are made of flesh and blood and not sentient programmings.
Yeah, I mean, can computers do cannibalism? Can you eat a smaller program?
I don't. Well, I mean, think about whenever I wonder what computers can do, I always go back to the seminal document on the topic, the movie Tron. It seems like
They do eat. They drink water with their frisbees.
They drink water with their frisbees.
You never see them eat.
I think that they explode other programs rather than
they do.
They torture them and then
tase them and zap them.
Yeah, but they don't. They never consume them, right?
Yeah. What do they eat? They eat chips.
Ugh.
No.
You belong in a different kind of jail.
I guess that's
a dark jail.
I guess they don't eat chips. They're in the chips. They're the ghost.
They are the chips. Yeah. In the unlikely event that any of this makes any sense to you, future computer kelp beds, our shows are archived on social media at Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can see what Ken has to say about things at Ken Jennings on, well, really on Twitter. He stays off of all the other social media. I do not participate in mainstream social media, but I have my own walled garden.
In the dark web.
In the dark web. There's a social media discourse that is connected to my Patreon at patreon.com/John Roderick. But you should focus your attention on the Omnibus Project Patreon, which is at patreon.com/Omnibus Project. Your support for our show helps us continue to discuss esoteric topics like adjunct members of the Donner Party. That was a topic suggested by one of our Patreon supporters.
Thank you, Axel.
And you can also suggest your own strange topics that probably have some familial connection.
We'll do each member of the Donner Party in turn.
One at a time.
If you pay us enough. We have no scruples.
So go to patreon.com/omnibusproject and tender your support to our show. You can email us, and that will get almost certainly to one of us directly, eventually, after Mindy Jennings reads it and censors all the dirty words, at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. You can interact with other futurelings by Googling futurelings.
And then just talking to whoever appears.
Yeah. Go to Facebook, go to Instagram. Actually, you can just go into your holodeck and say, Futurelings! And the Council of Elders of Futurelings will appear around you.
Yeah, in your time, you're probably some kind of weird pale fish living in a symbiotic relationship with some kind of rainbow fungus. And the Futurelings will be similar.
Yes.
Fish-fungus pairings.
They will welcome you. Welcome you into their refracting pools. And you can mail us things, and this is very important that you remember this. You can mail us actual things in real life at P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. Ken, do you have any mailbag stuff? Usually you're rifling through a big box at this point in the show.
Should I produce some mail? This is what a listener named Luca sent to us. It's a photo series he shot while living in Tokyo called Signs of Japan, where he wanted to document amazing illustrated street signs that were once prevalent in Japan but were kind of falling out of fashion. So he sent us each a copy of the book he produced with, you know, some of the thousands of photos of kind of fun cartoony Japanese public warning signs.
Oh, these are fun.
These are really great.
And these have fallen out of fashion?
I guess, which is a shame. I want to see a cute little Astro Boy wearing a hard hat every time I yeah. every time I approach a construction site in Tokyo.
It's like there's Speed Racer and he's got who is the little boy in Speed Racer that had the monkey friend?
Chim Chim and Spritel.
Spritel. There's little Spritel with his blue hat running from a construction site.
This car, I wish I read Japanese. This car is angry about something, and the eyes are actually the eyes of the windshield, Pixar style, and not the headlights.
Well, so I've got a car here with surprise headlights as a little boy that looks like Pac-Man is chasing a ball across the street, and this car is like, say what?
I assume this was inspired by our discussion of Japanese signage in the English as she is spoken.
Oh, yeah. A lot of little boys in Japan during this era wore like Spanky and Our Gang style blue baseball hats.
Yes, apparently. And always shorts in all weathers. This is fantastic work.
Yeah, that's nice.
Luca, thank you so much. We'll put photos up on the Patreon feed so others can enjoy a sample of your work.
Right on the coffee table is where that goes.
Listeners, from our vantage point in your distant past when coffee tables still existed. We have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe that kills us all may never come. But if the worst comes soon, and the attendant cannibalism, this recording, like all our recordings, may be our final word. But if Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.